It's Dr. Tennant's Verbal Highs. Let's start the show with Lewis Tennant. Here we go. The guests and interviews that you're looking for, with creators, innovators, and so much more. For all episodes and further info, verbalhighs.com is the place to go.
Welcome to Dr. Tennant's Verbal Highs, a podcast podcasted from a kitchen bench in what can only be described today, folks, as sunny Kingsland, Auckland, New Zealand. It's a stunner here. The episode proper was recorded last week, and then you are listening in the future. So much time shifting. Ah, goodness, a life in podcasting. So this morning I listened to an episode of one of my favourites, long-term podcasters, Adam Buxton. He's got some great new eps up. Then I'm in the throes of marking a five-minute podcast. I took over a paper called Audio Production Techniques from Thomas, who was actually the first ever guest on this show. And being that we're a comm school, not a music school, it's not just knobs and sliders and the technical side of things. They do learn a bit of a new DAW. We have them on audition in this one, but it's also storytelling. So it's basically make a podcast course. And if you've got to mark anything, I watched my colleagues marking some handwritten media communication essays yesterday. If you're going to mark anything, five-minute podcasts are a fun bet, and I was listening through before, and I'm actually really proud of them, and I'm thinking that in the next few episodes, I'm going to seek permission from some of these young stars of the future and hopefully put one of their podcasts within mine, because as I say, they're only about 5 minutes each. I've been saying to them that they should do it after the course and that I'll help where possible. I think it's quite an easy way to sort of keep your chops up, keep producing content, you know, build a body of work while you're studying. It was all looking, what's the expression, hail and fire and brimstones last week with episodes. I mentioned I was really behind. I came to the party, got a bit motivated, but then, you know, other people have as well, which is a beautiful thing. I've got to get them up every 7 or 8 days to make 26 in 2018. But I can tell you that this is unprecedented, folks. Next Tuesday at 2 p.m. I'm recording with, I can't tell you who I'm recording with, but I'm recording with someone. Then the very next day, 4:30 p.m. Wednesday, timetable's filling up, I'm recording with someone else, and then 4 p.m. Wednesday the week following, goodness, verbal highs are right, I'm recording with, of course, someone else who I can't tell you. Then I go down to a pinball competition in the sunny Hawke's Bay, and I have organised in that weekend as well to do a recording, an episode with someone who has been on the list since the beginning, someone who is one of the Don Dadas, if not the Don Dada, of a certain music genre in New Zealand. It's a small place. Some of you will probably guess who I'm meaning by going that far. A person of that description lives in the Hawke's Bay. Anyway, so that'll be a super special episode because, like Roger Perry and a few others, we don't normally talk to journalists, all right? And they seem to like what I'm doing. And then one of the patrons of the show, I'll mention the patrons later on, Ms. Jane Five, dear friend, has teed me up with someone who is just music industry royalty. Very, he's going to have a lot of stories, this other person. So those all coming up. And then I think I did a head count this morning, and I'm going to make my 26, which is super duper. Speaking of patrons, shouts to, and this is not why they did it, but over the past nearly 2 years, I have had donations in kind from Craig Spragan, a man called Tama Taipua in Australia. Completely anonymous donation till I spotted his name, but I certainly don't know him. And he actually put forward a really generous amount of money last year, which nearly paid for the web subscription for the whole next year. So shouts to you, bro. My bro, Matt Thompson, Mr. Jack Pepsi, has fired through some money twice, you know, like he said something like it's, you know, getting your video out from the video shop back in the day. And the aforementioned Jane and hubby Felix Five also were very generous last year. So this is a passion project, but I am coming up to renewing the website and the domain again. So if you do enjoy the show. You have listened to a few and you feel like chucking a few squids my way, there is a donate button on the website, verbalhighs.com. Okay, so just quickly, yesterday was my birthday, but I was bogged down in due diligence because very excitingly I was about to buy my first property. And how did I do that? I put my name in for the Kiwi Build ballot and my name was drawn. Admittedly, it was drawn for the smaller end of what I wanted. I put my name in for 18. The punchline to all of this is at about 4 o'clock yesterday, the lawyer phoned and I basically said, lay it on me. If you were me, would you do this? And she said, absolutely not. That's why I'm calling before you emailed. So, fascinating kind of result in a way. Like, lawyers are supposed to point out the worst case scenarios and then leave you be. In this case, she felt that I needed to pull the plug and get out of Dodge. So I'm house hunting. My guest is Jackie Van Beek, and we had a great chat. It was a little bit stiff for the first 20 minutes. I was a little bit overbearing with the questions, I thought. I always do this on the podcast. The first thing they tell you on radio is not to point out, what you haven't done right. But, anyway. And I think Jackie was more used to doing sort of press interviews. And then once she kind of got it, that was a conversation, we have quite good rapport going on by the end. It's really fun. And, of course, her main claim to fame recently is she's directed her second feature film. Man, I just have the utmost respect for people who direct films. It comes across in the episode. Actually, I'm like kind of like, oh, how do you do it? Sort of a silly question, but amazing feat to put together. I just think film is one of the great, human inventions, really. Anyway, but her film, the smash hit Breaker Operas. My apologies to Jackie. That dawned on me after I did the episode that I hadn't actually seen any of her work. Normally that's part of, me going into it. But I do say in the same breath that I missed the Breaker Operas because the cinema run just came and went on me. But it is coming out on DVD and streaming platforms, so I'll be seeing it then. And I'd urge you to as well. If you like the show, Verbal Highs podcast on Facebook, Verbal Highs on Twitter. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Jackie Van Beek. Actually, I forgot my brown fizzy patron. Thanks, Hellertown. And thanks, Dave, from Hellertown.
This is Dr. Tannen's Verbal Highs.
Well, we normally do an hour and 20 minutes. Is that too long?
So long. I'm like, so what the hell are we going to talk about? It's like 20 minutes, and I'd be like, oh yeah, 40 minutes. An hour 20? Surely not.
Maybe an hour.
What are we going to talk about?
Everyone else has managed it.
Have they?
Yeah.
Okay. Don't feel afraid of
Can you move the mic up?
Don't feel afraid of going, you know what? Let's call it a day, Jacket.
Okay, sure. Do you want to move it up a little bit more? Okay.
Like that?
It's odd. It's odd having you stand. It feels like
a
power imbalance.
You could stand. You should stand.
I could, but then it seems like
you're crunching your lower lumbar. Oh. Right there, you are. You're crunching your lower lumbar.
I have back. I think I have hereditary kind of back issues, and I have a weird, you've been to the back expert, I have an overly slopey, archy bit.
You mean your curvature is too pronounced?
Yeah, not like you'd like go, oh my God, look at that, like,
that
Jim Rose circus guy, but
right.
Definitely, yeah. So how do you avoid crunching your...
standing, not sitting.
Okay.
But if you're sitting, just basically not slouching.
And these are, from what you've learnt about back issues in the last however long you've been seeing your specialist, those are not great stools, are they? Is it better if you have something for your legs to...
Look, I don't know much about this, but all I know is what I'm trying to do at the moment is to avoid sitting. And when I stand, don't lock your knees.
Yep.
And try and kind of... be as tall as you can, you
when
know.
When you stand, don't lock your knees.
No, don't lock your knees. So just a slight bend of the knees. Because if you lock your knees,
I'm standing up,
then it does stuff to your back, you know.
So I thought, I thought...
It's bad.
I thought that you would be full-time in your craft, but you just said you've finished your job, so you have a day job as well?
No, I don't have a day job. I have just been doing a voice job, actually.
Oh, cool.
For
radio?
The Warehouse.
Nice.
Yes.
Is that a regular?
It's just becoming regular, I believe. I have not signed a contract.
That is a great thing to get, because once you're locked in, when they need your voice as part of the brand,
yeah,
that's some nice living money.
Yeah, like you always hope to become regular, don't you?
I did it in the 90s, and my listeners would have heard this before. I'm sure I've mentioned it once or twice, but I got shortlisted for the New World Voice.
Ooh,
which would have meant...
Nice.
So both of us sitting here, standing and sitting here quietly, know that it's good money for not a lot of time, right, in terms of going into the studio.
As I said, I haven't seen my contract, but I'm hoping it's right. Good money.
But it would have been nice, because I used to pick them up every few months or whatever, but getting one every week, essentially, broccoli is... 99 cents this week. Bluebird chips. It would have been
still
great.
Exciting.
And I was down to the last three, but someone else pipped me to the post.
Oh yeah, but I think I think most voices, you know, the people. There's a bit of a turnover, isn't there? Like you might last a year, and then they look for a fresh voice.
Not if you become an integral part of the brand.
Right.
They used to fly. Remember when we used to have to call our voicemail and stuff, and Telecom had the same male voice all through the '90s. Well, he moved to Australia, and they'd have to fly him back every time they wanted him to do it, because they just couldn't lose that amount of their branding.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, wow. Well, yeah. Fingers crossed.
Good luck! Okay, I better say who I'm with here. This is stolen from online. I didn't write this. With the multi-talented Jackie Van Beek, who emerged from the Wellington 90s theatre scene. After directing a run of award-winning shorts, her first feature, The Inland Road, was invited to the 2017 Berlin Film Festival, and sounds weird, she, while you're here. You went on to direct, co-write, and co-star in comedy The Breaker Upperers with Madeline Sami, and you've acted, it says here, perhaps best known for your role in What We Do in the Shadows.
Yeah, well...
And least known as playing a lettuce.
Oh, oh, yeah. That was a rock bottom moment.
Was the lettuce with the improvisers?
Yeah, it was. I was... Yeah, so I was employed by the improvisers, an improvising company who mainly work with doing corporate gigs.
Murder mysteries.
Oh, there was the murder mystery. They were the kind of dinner evenings. Yeah. But then I was also working a lot, and this is when I was 17 and 18, yeah. You know, straight after high school. But yeah, that's right, going out to a... And the lettuce incident happened, I think it was actually a telecom conference. And I was employed, and another man was employed, can't remember his name. I was dressed as a lettuce. My head was like an hour of makeup, like green makeup. My face in my head, and full of lettuce. And he was dressed as grapes, so he had purple hair. And we had to get under a table. There were two holes in the buffet table.
Yeah.
So we were placed under the table and had to poke our heads through and then just wait for the telecom workers to come out for their buffet lunch, and then we had to make amusing quips.
So you were like live versions of those. I'm sure there's a thing on Sesame Street with fruit and veg in the fridge and stuff that talks. And
yeah,
I was doing that at the same time as well. Were we?
That's
at
right.
The improvisers
at the same time.
Same
I believe
time?
Certainly there was crossover.
Yeah,
I didn't last much longer after the lettuce incident.
Again, why is this all becoming about money? It was good money.
Oh yeah,
especially for a 17, 18-year-old or whatever we were.
Oh yeah,
but the boss just didn't like me, so it wasn't gonna.
Oh, that's sad.
Wasn't gonna last. But Tim Jones is still there, 150 years later.
Is he?
Yeah.
I was looking at a photo of Tim Jones because I found my old school photo albums yesterday as I was clearing out the shed.
And you grew up in what part of Wellington?
In Jayville, Johnsonville.
What schools before Onslow?
So I went to what was called Johnsonville West School, it's called like something like West Park or something kind of flash now. Johnsonville West, and then I went to Rarua Intermediate.
Family still there?
No. I just had to think for a moment. Are they? No, they're not. My parents have been living in and just out of Melbourne for the last 20 years.
Wow.
My sister has actually just returned to Wellington. She's teaching at Toi Whakaari now.
I just remember your sister as you say that. Mm. Wellington's so small.
Yeah.
And what brought your folks to Jayville?
Well, I was born in Twizel, so we came up from Twizel, and
they really like the hit spots in New Zealand, right?
Twizel, I mean the memories. No, yeah. I don't have any because we moved when I was two. it was for Dad's work, yeah. So Ministry of Works. He was, and I guess still is, an engineer. And my mother really liked this property in Johnsonville because it was on top of the hill, and so she thought it was going to keep her fit, which it did.
Which it did.
Until she did her back, actually.
Right.
When she was about my age, when I did my back at the age of 40.
I do notice going back to Wellington, Jayville or not Jayville, that you do maintain a level of fitness there just because of the hills and the elements. Like, we're all kind of like mad mountain climbers without knowing it while living there.
I know, I love that aspect because I live in a beautiful suburb now in Auckland. Langholm.
Yeah.
And we moved out there and we built a house out there because of, you know, all the native bush and the beaches, and it's paradise. But I'm always in the car because, you know, I do so much work in and out of the city. Whereas in Wellington, you could get away with not having a car.
No, that's right. I had a license. Mum was like, you've got to get a license. It's kind of quite clever of her because it's sort of like probably more valuable than school certificates been for me in a lot of ways. but I didn't actually, I'm right with you, I didn't actually drive till I got a job in Melbourne years later. Like, I had I was still driving like a really unconfident 17-year-old at 27 till I got that job. You and your sister, kind of, you both ended up performers one way or another. You have ended up performers. Has that come from mum or dad or both? Or
Well, Paula's not so much a performer. She's teaching at Toi Whakaari, but her main line of work has been directing or light. She's an amazing lighting designer.
That's right.
She ran Bats for a little while in Wellington, and then she went over to London for a bit. And
but still in that world. Definitely. So did your folks sort of bring you up with a love of performance and theatre, or did you guys sort of discover that?
No, my mother was a puppeteer. My mother was a puppeteer for what used to be called the Crippled Children's Society, which was then
I remember then those puppets coming around primary school.
That was my now. Then it was changed to called the CCS. You know that,
and they
like Kentucky
big.
Fried Chicken.
They were quite big for puppets, and they had big mouths.
And they were all disabled.
Yes,
yes, they lived with us.
Wow,
in a big red bag. Yeah, and when I used to get really mad with my sister when we were young, of course, and I get
you
really mad with her, I would zip her. I would Velcro her into the bag with the disabled puppets because she was smaller than the puppets, and I wouldn't let her out.
So, did your mum build them?
No, they were all made in the States, actually. So my mum did the puppeteering around the schools, but then she also was supervising and training all of the other teams. Andrew Foster, you might remember him from Wellington. He was one of the CCS puppeteers for a little while there.
So is she looking through, like, the Evening Post, as it would have been back in the day, and she sees, like, you know, position vacant, or did she come from a puppeteering background?
No, she trained as a teacher.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Oh, you're going around schools, yep, spreading
messages. Yeah, so she'd write the scripts. And so, you know, I remember as a kid, I would, you know, mum would say, oh, come and help me with the script. Often they were absolutely shocking. Even as an 8-year-old, I was like, oh, this needs a lot of work. This needs a lot of work before it can make the stage.
So you started off in sub-editing the creative content.
but also my mum and dad have a, you know, huge love of the arts and still do, you know. They took us to every show at Downstage. You know, we were at the ballet, we were at the opera, we were at all the site-specific fringe works. They just absolutely loved it. So we were very lucky.
How's Paula with puppets now?
I'd need to ask her, actually.
Don't ask her, just hide one somewhere next time where she's living. And you get to Onslow, and I don't even know if you remember, but there was a bunch of us from Wellington High. People obviously often say similar schools, and da-da-da-da-da.
That's right.
So a sort of art, drama, music focus along with everything else. But you were, I'm trying to think of the term, there was a particular pocket of talent that's endured from around your years, right? Yourself, Tyker.
He's doing okay.
Yeah.
He's enduring, is he?
He's enduring. And what I really liked about that, hearing that, is you guys have, that those links from back then have carried on, right? Like, you still work in those circles a lot, don't you?
Yeah, I do. I've worked with Tyker and
I just said you and Tiger. I'm sure there was a bunch of people.
Well, my bestie from high school, Gentian Lupe, she's been doing a lot of acting. But more recently, actually, she's become a
kickboxer,
Muay Thai fighter, and has like a world title. I mean, she's a maniac. She's a good actor.
You know
what
I love about that is, I mean, I remember Gentian well because actually when we did the school theatre sports, they plucked a bunch of us to be the Wellington team, and it was her, me, Tim Jones, and actually a girl whose name I forget from another school, not Welly High or Onslow. But she definitely did the 90s slacker vibe pretty well. I would have picked her to become a kickboxer.
She always said to me at school, Gentian would say, I want to be an actor or I want to be an athlete.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to be an actor or, you know, actor, dancer, director, whatever. She could never decide. And so she's done both.
But she's no slouch of a kickboxer, right? She's really high. Isn't she really highly regarded up there?
Oh, yeah. She's like a champion.
Have you watched her fight?
I watched her fight once and I found it absolutely horrific.
Yeah.
And I found myself thinking as I was sitting in the big stadium, as the blood was dripping down her opponent's face, I thought to myself, gosh, I'm glad I just love making short films. You know, that's where I get my kick.
Yeah.
Now features, you know.
I was wondering about that because I lost, you probably remember David Lawrence. We had this weird parallel thing through school where I turned up in his new entrance class, went through Lyle Bay School with him, then went through Evans Bay Intermediate School with him, then went to Wellington High with him, which was an odd school choice where we grew up. Most people went to Rongotai or East or whatever. Then we did the same degree at uni for the same years. But I sort of reacquainted with him again about 4 or 5 years ago. So you and Gentian have sort of kept, even before social media, you've kept in touch.
Wasn't David Lawrence the man who convinced Taika to play Othello?
He's the Shakespeare guy, pretty much. He's like
and I
the
never saw that production,
scholar.
But I heard it was brilliant. And I'd like to see Taika play Othello again.
Yeah. Are you saying that like it was an odd role for him, or it was sort of what people were talking about, how good he was as Othello? Or
He was so kind of focused on comedy that I was quite surprised to hear back in the day that he'd agreed to do Othello. And apparently he was very, very good. So next time I see Taika, I will see if he would like to.
Because Humour Beast around that time was David, Taika and not Jermaine, maybe David, Taika and Brett.
Well, I thought, long ago. I thought, wasn't Humour Beast's Jermaine and Taika? And wasn't it So You're a Man? Or Like You're So You're a Man?
Oh, it's been so long. It actually has. It freaks me out. It actually freaks me out how
we're
long ago.
We're old now.
We are. We actually are old.
Kerry, maybe David, Jermaine.
Yeah.
So Brett, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, those guys used to be in a comedy troupe.
Uni, school. What happened after school? Did you go? Did you go straight to uni, or you would have been seventh form in kind of 93, maybe?
Are you
a year
there.
Or two older than me? Did you go straight to uni?
I did. What I did is I enrolled in a full-time contemporary dance course at the Wellington Performing Arts. I enrolled in full-time university.
Yeah.
And I probably did about 5 or 6 theatre shows that year. So spread myself too thin, I'll admit.
You were enrolled full-time at a dance school and full-time at uni.
Yeah, I mean, it was a night. And I kept going out of town because I'd be cast in these shows that would be touring the country. So I'm out of town.
How's your student loan?
Oh yeah, that got up there. My parents kindly paid it off a long, long time ago when they realised I was probably never going to be able to pay it off. So that was very kind of them with my grandmother's inheritance, which is sad.
No, that's nice.
Well, she was big, very big on education, Susie Sanders. But you know, the interest. I feel bad that her inheritance paid the interest off.
Well, that's not our fault. I read an article in North and South years ago now that was super interesting. Like we, pretty much the exact years you and I were doing tertiary study were historically the worst for that system they had set up. Because now you probably know, but you don't have to, providing you don't leave the country, you don't pay interest anymore.
Right.
So you just pay back the fees.
And first year free, is that right?
That's this year. Yeah. And I wonder at work whether, I've got no hard data for this, but I feel like less people have handed in all their work this year. So I'm wondering whether there's a few tire kickers, like now that there's a free first year, just going, no, it's not for me.
Just kind of.
And taking on off. Where were we with you? You were taking you were trying to go to two schools full time and doing six theatre shows.
I do think we should say though that, well, certainly if I can speak for myself, I am very pro free tertiary education.
Oh, absolutely. I wasn't.
I'd hate for people to listen to this and go, oh, yeah, no, we should. No, yeah, we should abolish that, Jacinda.
No,
what a stupid
that wasn't
idea. Free education.
That wasn't even. there was no subtext there whatsoever. I was just given to it. I'm from the shop floor, really. I've seen happening.
No, I know. It is
it's a great idea.
It is interesting.
So six theatre shows traveling around the country. Who was organising those? Doing fringe shows around the country?
Well, yeah, I think I toured maybe one or two shows, like kids shows, educational shows. And then I was doing a bunch of, devised shows for the Fringe Festival, Comedy Festival with my mates, Jeremy Randerson, Brett McKenzie, Joe Randerson. Oh, who was around at the time? There's Andrew Foster and Duncan Sarkis and
Who finds it hard to sort of be still or do nothing? Like, is it a workaholic thing, or just there were things on? And
I wouldn't describe it as a workaholic thing. I get very excited,
yeah,
very easily,
yeah,
about a lot of things.
it's a nice way to live.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I have had a few back issues recently, yeah, and that's really forced me to slow down.
I noticed you'd done shows in London and stuff. Would that eventuate? Was it actually, was that just touring for shows, or actually going and I'm going to do my 2 years in London or my however many years in Australia or whatever?
No, I didn't do an OE. I went over to the States, just took myself on a holiday when I was maybe 18 or 19 because I wanted to go to Nashville.
Yeah.
So I've been to Nashville a few times now. And so I wanted to tour around the States, so I did that. But only, I'd go for like 6 weeks at a time. So maybe I did that, two or three times.
Are you a country music person?
I love country.
It's not such a big genre in New Zealand, right? Where'd that come from?
No, in fact, I was just on my way here today, actually. I was listening to RNZ and they've got some expert talking about Polynesian country music,
wow,
which was quite, but they were saying the same thing.
Of the 60s, and I'd say there'd be a 60s, 70s thing for Polynesian country music.
Yeah, it's sounding
now
quite different to what I was listening to at the Grand Ole Opry. delightful, actually. But they were saying, Jesse Mulligan was also saying, oh, yeah, it's not so big in New Zealand. Big in Australia. I lived in Australia for a few years, it's big there.
It's big like the States there.
And I'm talking like alt country. I'm not at home listening to Hank Williams as I am as
have
Ryan
of,
Adams.
Have you heard of Palace Music? Will Oldham?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Great old country.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So you're not yanking my chain. That's the main reason that you went over there, was the love of the music. Is that why it was like Nashville on the map of the States?
Yeah, I wanted to go to Nashville.
Yeah.
And then I thought, well, I should tour around a few places. So I went down to New Orleans because a good music scene down there as well. Went to Austin, great music scene there. Yeah, so I went over to kind of listen to some music. And it was quite fun just touring around by myself as a kind of, naive Kiwi, kind of 19 years old.
Americans with even less idea then than they do now of where New Zealand is.
Exactly, it's beautiful.
Do you think, that if we just call it the Taika phenomenon, maybe the Peter Jackson phenomenon, do you think that's put us on the map a lot more? I think of what you guys accomplish now compared to when we were coming up in the 90s and it feels like it's all much more of a realistic proposition now,
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I've spent a lot of this year promoting the Breaker Operas with Madeline. Yeah. And we premiered in Austin in South by Southwest in March. And, it's interesting. There's been a real shift because people, when I used to go to the States, were like, Peter Jackson, if I'm at a film festival or something. Peter Jackson. And now it's like, Taika and Flight of the Conchords and Rhys Darby. And then hopefully now they'll be, the Breaker Operas, hopefully.
Yeah, yeah.
But people are really much more easily able to identify, like they'd say after our screens, they go, that was New Zealand comedy. We're like, oh, was it?
And is it still, but it's still like, there's Thor, but it's still in the best possible way, like a sort of a, in terms of sort of numbers and demographics, it's a sort of PBS, HBO demographic, isn't it? There's a core of sort of comedy nerds who like what we do.
Oh, yeah. Like,
what do you think the Americans like about there is this unique, there's this New Zealand thing that goes overseas. I can't quite put my finger on. What is it they like about us? Are they laughing at us or with us?
I think they used to be maybe laughing at us and then like turning off the telly after a few minutes because they can't understand what we're saying.
Yeah.
But now, no, I definitely think there's been, you know, the world is, the world, you know.
Go on, go with it.
A few people in the States and the UK have been embracing, you know, I think New Zealanders, we have this kind of deadpan, reserved, slightly bumbling charm about us.
A little bit of the empire left in us.
Yeah, that's right. A bit naive, a bit maybe overly honest, not, you know, like trying to get it right and not quite getting it right. And I think we used to be quite embarrassed about that as a nation.
Yeah.
But I think now we're actually beginning to be able to laugh at ourselves and celebrate it as well.
But also, I think I totally hear you, but I think we kind of do, I'd like to think we do know what's up as well, but I sort of like, now you make me think about it, how that aspect of us is what's being played up a lot of the time.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right, because, I mean, we know, don't we, Lewis,
living
in New Zealand, that there's a whole range of different people here.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's right. I mean, what the Concords have made kind of famous, and also, you know, Taika is that kind of, yeah, like, you know, you don't need many words to express, you know. Express your feelings. You can express your feelings in one or two words and in a bit of a mumble and then kind of finish your sentence as you're walking away.
Yeah. I always crack up when people really, you know, with the best possible intentions, try and do our accent and it sounds like a weird sort of Queensland meets Britain sort of. When I lived overseas and came back and heard newsreaders, I actually had a bit of cultural cringe then. Mm. It's an odd sounding dialect.
It is.
When you're away and you come back.
I've experienced that as well, especially when you're over in the States or something. Everything's kind of so soft and they just speak a little bit more slowly. In some parts of the States. And yeah, when I've come back, it is quite, I do find our accent quite funny. And I'm not hugely good at accents, I'll admit.
No.
So I'm really glad that New Zealand accent is my native accent because I'd never be able to do it.
I've heard maybe once or twice I've heard someone, an outsider, do it well. So you were touring shows though. You ended up doing, I couldn't quite figure out the gist of the show, touring My Brother and I Are Porn Stars. Mm. How did that one come about? Because it seems like you did dates at quite a lot of different spots.
Very popular show, that one.
Yeah. Written by you guys?
Yeah, so we devised that show. Johnny Bruff and I were it was a duo. For me, old mate Johnny and me. And
what year are we in?
Oh, gosh, it'd be 2006.
Yeah.
And we devised it with Colin Mitchell and Jodie Malloy. So Jodie Malloy is kind of a writer. Colin Mitchell directed the show.
Yeah.
And we all devised it. And then Johnny and I went on the road and we toured around New Zealand and, you know, festivals. And we went to Melbourne Comedy Festival. We did the Edinburgh Fringe. And then we were invited to Soho Theatre.
I get it. Because the Fringe is about a show pretty, you know, it's, they make it and often they don't they? So once you get sort of Fringe accreditation, you can take it places, can't you? Isn't that how it works? Like once the Fringe is kind of, you can say no, Lewis, it's completely
fucking
wrong.
What do you mean? Like, are you talking about Edinburgh Fringe?
Well, no, you're just talking about how you got it to sort of London and stuff. I was looking at that today when I was doing a little bit of research.
Oh, good on you.
And I just thought, I saw you done a bunch of dates in the UK. And I just wondered how you get audiences without a pre, you know, kind of hype around it.
Well, Edinburgh Fringe is I've only performed there once, but I've been there a number of times because my husband Jesse has performed there a lot.
Who incidentally is a country artist as a character, isn't he?
Oh yeah, Wilson Dixon. I really want to make a film about Wilson Dixon. We're working on it.
I did think that too. A short film.
Yeah. You know, it was a match made in heaven when I met Jesse the same night as I met his alter ego Wilson Dixon.
I was like, you met him in character.
Well, pretty much on the same day.
Everything you've told me that
on the same day. I was just like, oh my god.
Were you let down when you found the real? Anyway,
when he took off his wig.
Yeah.
No. I did know Jesse from around the traps a little, from afar.
I recognise him. He's a Wellingtonian, isn't he?
Dunedin.
Oh, okay. So I recognised his face from somewhere.
Yeah. He was in the Four Knolls, so he performed a lot up and down New Zealand, and he studied with John Bolton in Melbourne. Anyway, why are we talking about Jesse?
Because I'm Selwyn Toogood, and this is your life.
Oh, wow. What was your last question? Because I half answered
it. I remember. No, it was my fault. I sent you off down a different direction. You were talking about the Edinburgh Fringe.
Ah, yeah.
And I was asking how one gets crowds in London when one is pretty much like everyone else trying to put on a show. And you were going to relate it to Edinburgh.
So Edinburgh Fringe, it's kind of acts as a bit of a, like a, this huge marketplace. And, you know, so talent scouts and producers will be in and out of shows. And I really loved it, actually. It was quite liberating. You'd have people come into your show while you're performing, and they'd stay for 10 minutes, then they'd get up and leave. Even if they're in the front row, like four of them will just get up and leave. And sometimes it's just drunk people that hate your show, or even sober people that hate your show. But often it's like these bigwigs, and you know that they're bigwigs. Like, we knew like that the Soho Theatre guy
really intimidating.
Was coming in to check us out.
Yeah.
And we knew where he was sitting, and we went back, you know, went quickly backstage to quickly get changed halfway through the show. We came out and he'd gone. And, you know, we've all seen films like this.
Yeah.
And we were just like, then we got programmed, and what we realized is that they are seeing so many shows that they can only see 10 minutes of your show. And then they're like, we'll pick that up.
And they'll have some notation system. They'll tick or cross.
And then you have a meeting with them and they buy you lunch, and then you find out. And so we got the opportunity to perform at Soho because they'd seen us at the Edinburgh Fringe. And then the first season went so well that they invited us back.
Wow.
And when I say well, we got a 1-star review, but it sold out. But I do remember a lovely man called Steve Locke, who I think still is at Soho Theatre. We said to him, oh man, we got a 1-star review, you know? Like, because we'd had 4-star reviews in Melbourne, and we'd had some 2-star. I mean, it was a great show because people either loved it or they absolutely hated it.
Yeah.
We got a 1-star review, and I always remember Steve said, look, that's fine by us, because what we aim to do is program like shows that could be 1-star, could be 5-star. We don't want to program 3-star shows. And so he was like, good on you, now you get out there and you do it again, guys.
Sort of like how, that just reminds me of the cult film, like the film that everyone slated in the 70s that people spend the next 30 years going to see on Friday nights.
Exactly.
What do you think of reviewers in general? Like, I mean, there must be times, you know, where it does fuck you off that you put all this work in and, you know, do you think...
No, I'm not, but I mean, I feel like reviews are great for people who are reading those publications wondering what to go and see, or people that are following your work and say, oh, what did this person think of this person's work? For me, I certainly don't use them as a guide to guide my process.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that would be very dangerous. I barely read reviews. I think for the Breaker Uppers, I read 3.
Yeah. Really? And that must be, I mean, yeah, you don't want to sort of end up, you know, halfway through a bottle of wine and sort of decide to look at 10 of them, you know?
Well, the thing
so
is
there some self-control
too bothered there? I'm not too bothered by reviews. Like, I will become, you know, I'll become disheartened if I have created something that I don't think is up to scratch.
Yeah.
So that will be the...
I'm my worst critic, or whatever. And it's interesting you saying that word critic, because I think that's what's changing in society. Well, it's not my original idea. It's stuff I've thought about, talked about with others.
Yeah.
We are not just talking about, you know, people who, you know, critique your work and so on.
Mm.
We're losing the critics in society, and we're going to this world where everyone can and does review, which is like everything sort of being Yelp rated or, you know. So I think there's still a great space for critics, but I think especially people who don't put their name to stuff have no right to kind of review anything online.
Well, I don't know. It doesn't bother me. Like, I'm very strongly focused in creating content.
Yeah.
And that's what I do, and that's what I love doing. And then it's so, I mean, the only reason you create content is to get it to an audience.
Yeah.
And if some of the audience wants to write their little blog about it and slate it, I mean, that's completely up to them. But then it's up to other people whether they want to read that blog or whether they want to be guided by that.
Well, it's good to know that you don't have the same self-esteem issues I do. Because
someone
gave a 1-star for the show and I cut on iTunes and I cut and pasted it and put it on my my Facebook page for promoting the show. And then after about 2 days, I went, that's really douchey, just take that off.
Well, it's quite funny. It's quite funny.
Yeah, no, but like, I mean, me posting it going, oh, poor me. You know?
Right. Yeah, no, look, I'm not, I mean, it's never fun to be told, oh my gosh, did you read that terrible review of your show last night? But at the same time, I would be, as I said, it's, if I'm happy with it, That's the main thing. And then of the people I respect, i.e. my friends and family and, you know, other people that I respect, if they, like, if they hate it, I would let them guide me. Like, that would guide me.
Jackie, that is so interesting you say that. I've thought about the don't worry, I have no, I'm thinking of some existential crisis about this thing you're recording for me at the moment in front of you. Mm-hmm. But no, that's just it. The people who I respect in many different ways, shapes and forms, who've said little things to me about things I do, you know, the stuff I've done, that I'm, that's right. They're the ones you go, that's who keeps you going. Because you're like, ah, that person's got a great ear or a great eye, and I think they're smart, and you know, you know, their feedback on stuff's good.
You've got to choose who to listen to.
That's
right. But you know, like,
that's why you don't listen to like Johnny977 who comments with that. People who, I think people who comment on stuff, hey, I might even mean, you know, Uber delivery services, just that whole culture of no one being accountable for their feedback, I think's not a great place to be going.
But the only thing you can control is whether you, A, read it or don't read it, or B, let yourself be affected by it or not. Yeah. You know, you can't control. I know I have no desire to control what people right,
no,
you know, I think
right.
All power to them, unless it's horribly destructive, you know. With
hey, now, when Di was on here, he told me something interesting about the Edinburgh Fringe, in that, you know, it can actually be a bit of a gamble, if sort of, you know, sort of the way he was putting it, sort of business wise as well. Like, he was, you know, he said he, you know, you can seriously invest in your. And your fringe shows, because they're your sort of vehicles and stuff. Sounds a fascinating process. Is the place just a buzz the whole time, day and night for it, I'd imagine?
Yeah. I mean, it's just like, it's pretty intense. It's pretty fun. But it's basically a whole lot of people will lose a lot of money, you know, on their shows.
But a whole lot of people have great stories come out as well.
You kind of got it. Like, you know, you look at someone like Rose Matafeo, you know, who just won the big award this year.
Yep.
Like, she's been going year after year. Like, and you just, if you are that, you know, especially if you're a comic or, like, you just do need to do that, you know, because it is such a great kind of launching.
So you're a colleague and a friend of hers, you know, through Funny Girls and stuff. You must be pretty happy about that. It's a pretty amazing thing for her to.
Oh, it's amazing. I think you know, I think we're also, you know, excited for her, and there's always that kind of, you know, it's always good for the rest of us as well.
That's right. Back to that's what I was saying. This funny little country with the weird accent. It's good for all of us.
One person's success, you know, and we're all beaming.
Another one. We're going to talk about filmmaking and stuff shortly, but another one I saw that stuck out to me just because, for a number of reasons, it's just a great show that's kind of forgotten a lot of the times. Is you did the live version, or you were a character in the live version of Hudson and Halls?
Yeah.
Do you remember those guys growing up?
I know my mother remembers it, because when I got cast in that show, first thing I did was ring my mum and go, why wasn't this on? Like, you know, I was born in, you know, I was growing up in the 80s. Why was this not? She's like, it was on.
Yeah, I remember it. I remember it because we had two channels. You should remember everything.
What I was saying to my mum, why didn't you turn the TV on? You know, why don't I remember this? Yeah. I remember The Dukes of Hazzard. I remember MASH. I remember... But she remembers it, but I don't remember watching it. But
I found it was amazing. I laughed so hard watching it again. It was only recently, because not only the obviously openly gay on television, but their innuendos are just so thick and fast. It's just every second or third thing can be read into. Fantastic.
Yeah. And being drunk on air is quite exciting as well.
Well, they're so drunk. In some episodes they wouldn't get through the recipe.
Yeah.
I go, what is what? I go, excellent. And so how do you do it as a stage show? Who are you? Hudson Halls.
No. So that's right. So Chris Parker and Todd played those characters, and I played the floor manager.
Yeah.
And I actually met the real floor manager, because we met all these people who came to the show, because I was just in the first season and then it toured and I stepped out. So we met all of these people. So I played a floor manager who was basically trying to wrangle these increasingly drunk and increasingly camp bickering twits on stage, which was so fun.
They are great. If you didn't already watch it in the research phase on New Zealand on Screen, because their wider story of their life's quite amazing, quite tragic at the end and stuff. There's a doco that's up permanently called Hudson and Hall's A Love Story. Worth watching. It's really, really interesting.
It's sad.
So to filmmaking, you started off in making short films, which is pretty much where all filmmakers and directors start off.
Yeah, as I said, I'd kind of grown up in theatre, you know, devising, acting, writing, directing, and had done bits and pieces as an actor on TV and things. But it wasn't actually until I moved to Australia which was about 12 years ago, and I met Jesse Griffin and Wilson Dixon. It wasn't until I actually, and then Jesse and I fell in love within like 4 days. So I moved in with him, came back, got all my stuff, moved over. But I didn't know anyone apart from Jesse. I didn't have any of my...
Melbourne.
Yeah, in Melbourne. Yeah, yeah, but I just didn't have any of my networks, like my people around me.
Yeah.
And so I was looking to do creative things, of course. And we were still doing Porn Stars and touring that and things. But Jesse had a job up in Alice Springs as a clown doctor, working in the hospitals there, just for a week. And he said, do you want me to get you a job up there? I said, yeah, get me a job.
Yeah.
And so he got me a job teaching clown to a bunch of Indigenous kids that were living on a town camp in Alice Springs.
It's eye-opening up there, right?
Oh, it was amazing.
Yeah.
It was amazing. And so I spent a week teaching these kids, and we did a performance for the Desert Screen, you know, symposium, and it was amazing. And I came back down to Melbourne, and I was thinking, oh, I'd love to do something more with them. And I rang my boss up there from the Tangentyre Circus, and she said, somehow between her and I, we were thinking, because there were these two boys particularly that I thought was such a little great double act.
Yeah.
And she said, well, what about you come up here and we'll get some money from Tangentyre Council and we'll make a little short film, you know?
Yeah.
And so that was how I did it. So I was like, okay. And so I took a story from them, you know, something that I just kind of observed over that week.
Yeah.
It was a very simple story about at some of the schools up there, you're not allowed to go to school without a pair of shoes. But because, of course, all the kids on the town camp don't really own shoes, or they share shoes, and they often can't find their shoes before the bus comes.
Yeah.
So I just wrote a little story around how ridiculous that rule is, you know, to try and...
Sort of setting you up to fail.
And I must say, the school that we shot at didn't have that rule. What they had was a huge basket full of shoes just outside the classroom. So if the kids turned up and bare feet, they
could... the socialist shoe model. Rather than the punitive shoe model.
So that's how I fell into it. And then I just absolutely just loved it. It was all so new. I mean, I knew how to direct actors. I knew about storytelling, of course, through theatre.
Yeah.
But...
So you sort of wrote, I'm going to get the terminology wrong, like you sort of wrote a treatment or a synopsis or an idea, and then you developed it into like the screenplay for the short film. Or the...
It was more that I met those two boys.
Yeah.
Sarah from Tangentyre Circus said, what about a short film? I said, okay.
Oh, so those kids starred in it. It was them in the film.
Oh, yeah. Oh, right. Gosh, okay. Yeah.
And so you did that in Australia.
Yeah.
And how does it work over there with, I suppose these days with technology and stuff, you don't really need to worry as much about funding. So you just cut it all together on a computer and... You know, the production process.
We had
process
no money.
Stuff,
like,
no, money?
Yeah. No, I mean, so they got some council money from the Tangentyre Council up there. We had like $5,000. And then I managed to cobble a little bit of money together through the council in Melbourne.
Because
I wasn't eligible for, state funding, of course, because I was a Kiwi.
Yeah.
And we just made a little film. And then, it played in the London Film Festival and played all around the Northern Territories. And it was.
And I always, I wanted to talk, I'll probably come back to this later, but things... So that stuff either sticks around online or it disappears. Like, is this work still available for viewing? Like, have you got your earlier films up online somewhere? Or
I did try and get organised last year, and I did. I think I succeeded. I set up,
because if you biff it all on Vimeo, you own the rights to it, right? So
yeah, I put it on. That's right. I set up a Vimeo page.
Yeah.
So they're all. You can watch most
just
of them.
Under your
you can
name.
Watch most of them on there.
And how many? And oh, before we go on. You said clown, and I wondered whether, like, is it us non-clown people who say clowning? You say you talk clown? Is clowning not the right?
You know, no, clowning or clown.
Okay.
I mean, there's two differences. I mean, so people who aren't from maybe a theatre background will think I'm talking about those, like, Ronald McDonald clowns with the wigs and the thing. It's not that. Clowning is just a form of comedy.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Have you seen,
you know that,
have you
Lewis,
seen Baskets?
That. Have I seen Baskets?
Yeah.
No.
You want to see one of the best clown-based shows on television at the moment?
Galifianakis?
Yes.
Oh, I love him.
Oh, boy. You've got to watch that show.
Is it a teleseries?
It's a teleseries about a clown who's classically French-trained, who's just trying to get by in the States with his dysfunctional family who don't understand his passion and his art form.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
I can tell. You love it. So how many short films have you made?
I ended up making 6 short films and 1 short documentary.
So just quickly, See how quick you can do this. What were the other five about?
Okay, so I made one shoe short in Alice Springs. Then my second one I made in London when I was living over there with Jesse. That was called Just Like the Others, and it was, again, it's just I met a bunch of kids, and they had school holidays coming up, and me and my mate were looking for a way to keep them out of trouble because there was a lot of trouble happening around that in Hackney, around that estate.
Oh, you're in Hackney.
And so we said, well, let's make a short film because I want to make another short film.
Yeah.
And she got some council money, and my friend Bridget Fogarty and I, we just got a bunch of the kids and just wrote, again, I just wrote a story around from what I'd observed with these kids, and they acted in it.
Council estate?
Yeah.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
And what?
And then the third one, I was back in Australia and I made a film called Go the Dogs, again, just with council money.
Yeah.
And that starred a girl with special needs, and it starred a snake and a dog, and we shot
that. So your kids are a thing.
Yeah, cool. I love working with young people and non-actors.
Yeah.
As well as, I love actors as well, of course. But
and then the topics and themes of the, so we're up to four now, three, four?
Yeah,
four.
So three, so that was Go
so
the
you're back
dog.
In Australia?
That was, and we brought a wonderful Kiwi man, boy, young man, Graham Candy over for that, who I'd taught. I'd taught here. Then after that I made I offered to do a term at this school called Sunshine Special Development School with my friend Heath Lander, who I was living with. He was the art teacher there, and we said, why don't we do something? So I'll come in. And we did a version of Little Red Riding Hood, a 4-minute version, with about 48 kids with autism.
Yeah.
Then I moved back to New Zealand and...
Just stop me there for a sec. Did you move home because you wanted to, I mean, it's just an oft-told story. Did you want your kids to grow up in your home? Is it was to do with having a family or...?
I already had two kids by that point. We moved home because Jesse was doing a lot of work in the UK.
Yeah.
And I was just making short films wherever I was in the world just to keep learning.
Yeah.
And we realised that neither of us were earning any money in Melbourne. And so I rang him one time in London and I said, what? It just kind of occurred to me when I said, why are we living in Melbourne?
Because it's a fucking great city. That's one reason, but I hear you.
I
was there for 6 years. That's a great city.
Oh, it's a beautiful city. We were, however, living in Braybrook in a house that he'd bought just before I met him. And really good investment. We've sold it and now we live in Langholm.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was real. I mean, it was nuts, that suburb. It was crazy. It was pretty hardcore.
So you come, so decision to come back for sort of practical reasons. Why are we living in
the
place?
Well, because I had a lot more work potential back in New Zealand. Jesse wasn't working in Australia anyway, so he just started working in London.
So let me
get
this straight. His main gig is international, so he's working in the UK as a parody comedy, country artist.
As a comic. So he was mainly doing, Wilson Dixon. So he'd go and do comedy stores. He did a series with the BBC Radio. He was getting a lot of work over there, but we didn't stay there because
it's too hard to live there.
We just didn't really enjoy living in London. The weather, you know.
The vegetables, there's a number of things.
And a lot of grumpy people in stores.
No one told me when I went there, pre-internet, it wasn't pre-internet, it's ridiculous, pre-internet like it is now.
Mm.
In other words, I didn't Google a bunch of stuff before I went over. Mm. But anyway, of all the things you think people tell you, because they do give you advice when you're making quite a radical change like going there, no one told me. And what I found out when I walked out of an internet cafe at about 3:40 on one of the early days of winter, that it gets dark there before 4:00.
Oh, yeah.
It's such a bizarre way to live. I can see why everyone ends up in the pub every night.
Yeah, I mean, my ideal kind of environment and climate is, Northland, 9 p.m, it's still light, you're on a beach, it's warm. That's what I like. And that's not London, where I was having to get up because I was pregnant over there and I had a small baby. I was getting up at 5 a.m. in the dark to put my baby in a pram because Jesse would only arrive home from 3 a.m. from his shows.
Yeah.
So I'd put the baby in a pram, walk down a dark street in Wimbledon, and a couple of times I got to the park and the wrought iron gates were padlocked shut because I was too early and I'd just stand there like wanting to weep.
I just pictured a crow flying past.
Yeah, I mean, horrific.
What was the last short film you made?
I'll tell you what, I made two. I made a film called In Safe Hands. I must say that I was working with my producer, Aaron Watson, the whole time, who is just the most beautiful, clever man.
Yeah.
I made In Safe Hands, and that was based on a historical debacle with Green Lane Hospital, which was dubbed the Stolen Hearts
They stored hearts patients.
They
didn't
stored
they?
Them, but they didn't ask no. whether they could take those
what,
hearts.
What plans so. Did they have for them?
Well, they were doing medical research. Oh, yeah. And I think it's absolutely fine. I mean, I think I text an organ donor, of course.
I'm a donor, but I'd like to be told. You'd want to be, someone to be told.
You know, if it's because it was a children, so the parents were often not told, and that's what. And so I met someone who told me that story at dinner one night, and I was like, oh, man, that's very interesting. So I made that short film, and then I made a short film called Uphill, which was actually taken from my first feature screenplay that I was trying to write.
Yeah.
And so I took a sequence from the screenplay and made Uphill. And then I went back to Australia just for a little trip and made a documentary called The Lawnmower Bandit.
Television starts, not that you hadn't done TV, oh, by the way, you everyone has to do it in your racket. You've been on Shortland Street, haven't you? You've been the obligatory character on Shortland Street. Who were you and how long did you last?
I was cast twice, which is a little bit dismaying, and that means that my first character was totally unmemorable.
Yeah.
I can't remember
who I played. It's not like Tim Morrison came back. So why is he suddenly...
Yeah, obviously unmemorable. So the first time I was cast, I can't remember my character name. I was cast as Fergus's girlfriend, a real tearaway, really fun character. And I you know, if I do say so myself, was pretty bloody good.
Yeah.
As a new, like I was like 18, 17. Yeah, I know, I must have been older than that. I was 20 or something. Second time, years later.
So you were like a bad smoking teenager.
Yeah,
like,
you know.
All the crazy people smoke on Shortland Street.
Something like that. Yeah. You know, something like that.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it and I had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Then the second time I went back, I was terrible, which is interesting in hindsight. I was playing a salsa dance instructor that was either she was sleeping with someone, a character, who was either her brother or her boyfriend or her husband. And I remember saying to the writers, just as an actor, like, which one is it? And they were like, keep it ambiguous. And I was just like, what the?
I like the way casting both times with you says it's gonna have some element of dysfunction in it.
But I was terrible. I was terrible because I'd lost my confidence.
Well, also, I mean, I've had another guest on who talked at a reasonable length about Shortland Street in terms of it's such a high turnover, high speed production that if you do kind of lose, it's interesting you saying that because he sort of alluded to that. If you do lose your footing metaphorically, one way or another, it sort of can do that to you, sort of churn you up a little bit because it's just bang, 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 bang. We've got to get episodes out.
Oh, you've got to be like really. You just got to be so light with it and so kind of free.
And I know you. I know you're joking about how memorable your first character was, but you know the flip side of that is I went to school with a girl, Louisa, who was an ambulance driver on there for a very long time. Mm. Pretty much, I think that show started in '89, so she must have got cast end of school '93, '94. You probably recognise her character.
I remember
if you saw
her.
It. Yeah. Well, she basically left New Zealand afterwards because she was just sort of the person from Shortland Street.
Ah, right.
You know.
See, I didn't have that problem.
Yeah.
No, but I'd lost my confidence in between. I didn't lose it on Shortland Street. I just lost my confidence in between in those years. I've got it back now, so we can all celebrate that.
Yeah. All right. So, did performing was difficult for a period there?
No, not performing in theatre. I was doing a lot of that, and I was still, you know, really enjoying that. But I hadn't done much screen work, and then people say, you know, which I never do when I'm teaching, people say, oh, well, you know, there's certain acting for theatre and there's certain acting for screen. What I say to people when I'm teaching them acting, I'm like, as long as you're kind of playing, as long as you're playing truth, like as long as you're able to tap into something, the director will shape and guide you in terms of whatever genre or medium you're working in. Just let the director do that for you.
And don't let the difference in sort of procedure kind of freak you out.
Just think about the feelings. Just concentrate on the feelings.
I was thinking it's not really in our DNA here. It's not like, you know, if you grew up in arguably somewhere like LA, you know, there's a sort of that you know, it's an industrial system, isn't it? The screen side of things. So, I mean, that's one very good byproduct, aside from the fact that it's lasted and people watch it, all power to it for Shortland Street, is that it's created that, you know, like the other guest I'm thinking of, Jason, said, it really sharpens and hones you as someone in a production.
I'm looking forward to the musical, Shortland Street the musical, that I believe is on later this year.
I don't know if I'm looking forward to that, but...
I'm looking forward to potentially a free ticket.
I'm looking forward to hearing your Yelp review on it. But then, TV, you do Funny Girls, of course, which is a great show. How did that come on about? It's a sort of quite intergenerational group of comics, isn't it?
Yeah, so I've really only, and not for lack of trying, but I've really only entered the kind of New Zealand television industry very recently.
Good on you.
And now I'm, trying to create my own shows. So Funny Girls, I was cast in that. I was just cast in that by Bronwyn Becker.
Oh, so you weren't writing as well?
No, I was offered a role in writing to write my own character, but the writing team's so good there that I was like, no, let them write it, and then as long as I can improvise a little, let's just do it that way. So
we don't
have really fun. Yeah.
We don't have the budget for like a table of showrunners here, do we? It's just pretty much the creators that will write. I'm saying it'll be like two or three people rather than.
No, well, MediaWorks has... Well, I work a lot with Bronwyn Becker, who's the producer, one of the producers at TV3. So she produces Funny Girls, Jono and Ben. I recently directed a pilot for her, for one of the pilot seasons, Golden Boy. And so she has her team of people. So she might have... Oh, there always seems to be a whole bunch of them.
That's great.
Like 8 or 9 writers, writing for all of those shows. It's brilliant.
See, that's what I was meaning, Back in the day of sort of going to uni and stuff, I didn't even know such a role existed
in
New Zealand.
Well, I don't think it did.
No, it did.
It didn't.
Yeah.
Because my memories are...
Because that's sort of a dream job.
Oh, yeah. And with those, I'm sure that... I mean, we worked for the Improvisers, which was a brilliant opportunity.
Yeah.
And then I remember there was the comedy club, that people were doing stuff in terms of live comedy. But... Nah, these guys have got it good.
Hey, I saw that. Just something you mentioned. I saw that. I don't know if you know that Three actually played a selection of pilots the other
yes,
night.
Ours
so
it was
yours.
One of them.
No, that's what I'm saying. Yours was one of them. Yeah, but it was quite a cool move of Three. I didn't get it. Were they wanting the public to give feedback on which one they thought would go on to be a series, or they just played them all for?
I think there was a kind of three pronged kind of thing. I think what they said was they were. You're going to be looking at ratings, but then I'm not sure how that works because we're all on different nights. I think TV3 would have just decided which ones they thought had a longer life.
So Funny Girls, it's one of those shows, pretty much everyone I've talked to really rates it and the characters. And actually my colleague in my office today, I said I was going home to talk to you. And he said, oh, she was great in Funny Girls and so on. So how much of that was, we're talking about scripting and so on, how much of that was... You being open to improvisation, did you sort of craft the character in that way, or was it one of those sort of very much off the script?
It was a blend, but it was strongly scripted.
Yeah.
And that, like I was saying, that team of writers are so good. If you've got Rose Matafeo and Alice Sneddon and Chris Parker and Brinley Stenton, all of the, and Nick Sampson, if you've got those guys writing for you, it's so good to come in and have a funny script, and then of course I would improv, there'd be time and room for me to improv things. But no, it's quite a scripted show. Well, my ones were, because I was doing Pauline as a very inept television producer as the character, and I'm in all the behind the scenes scenes. I don't do any of the sketches.
Okay, well, I think we can get this cleared up pretty quickly. Check my record. You'll see that I have 6 tiny road rage incidents. And yes, in 1994 I got drunk and I stole the Pauline Avenue sign for reasons which I think are fairly obvious.
I got to, I don't know if you saw it, but I got to do a sketch with Jacinda the other day.
Really?
Yeah, I got flown down to the Beehive and did a sketch with her.
For where?
It was for the Funny Girls Suffragette special.
Oh, cool.
And it opens that special. And she was a lot kind of cooler, calmer
I
than
love,
I was.
I love how it just feels like an... She makes it feel like an era of sort of accessibility between her and the people,
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's really... It's a strong, You've gone all serious looking at me now.
Oh, no. I was just thinking about how much I love Jacinda. Yeah, I was just thinking, that was my recollection phase.
A whole lot of stuff's happened very, very quickly that I wasn't expecting to, which has been great too, societally. No, I was interested in that because I've learned a lot through listening to, I'm just this podcast junkie now, and and I've learned a lot about production through the fact that a lot of kind of stand-ups and similar people do the a lot of the British and American shows. And so I'd never really considered it, but it's been interesting, like, say, someone like Apatow apparently really gets people to play around and lots of improv. And then other people, you know, who've really meticulously crafted a script, it's about delivering those words, you know, as they were developed. It's an interesting thing.
I do a lot of improv. Even in my first feature, which was a drama, The Inland Road, you know, I wrote that script on and off for 7 years.
Yeah, wow.
And of course, you know, if you're asking for $1 million, you know, that script needs to be signed off by a lot of people, and it was. But then as soon as I cast it, I had a 2-week rehearsal period. So I brought the core cast down onto set in Arrowtown, and we re-improvised every single scene, so I could, and I didn't change the story structure, but I did rewrite all of the dialogue to suit the actors, and then on set I'd get them to do that, but we'd also do quite a lot of improvisation, especially with the non-actors.
And with digital these days, are you sort of saying, were you doing one set off the script and then a sort of a second take with improvising and just seeing which...
What I tend to do as a director is kind of let the actors kind of do what they like for the first take, and then and then if we've got time, I'll let them do it again the second take. And then I start to annoyingly micromanage them through very long, sometimes 10-minute takes, you know. I'll say, oh, great, now repeat that line. Okay, now walk to the window. Now say this. Okay, try saying it like this. Now, and I will be crouching annoyingly with a little wireless monitor, like just at their heels, going, okay, try this. And I do the same with comedy, of course. Yeah. And it's the same way that Taika and Jermaine work. You know, Madeline and I would do that in the Breaker Uppers. I really like it because it's so collaborative. It's not like, you know, you're not sitting way down the corridor and, you know.
Do you have moments of absolute terror? Because you're the director. You're like, it's all on your head, you know?
No, I have. What I have noticed about myself through the shorts and the features is I have increasing dread up until production.
Yeah.
And then as soon as we start, I just absolutely just love it. And I don't feel any terror because it really is just a process of discovery. And I really do think quite pragmatically about it, of like, my job is to facilitate a lot of talented people around me and just get the best shit I can on the hard drive.
And how have you learned to be a director? Is it, it's just years in theatre, years writing, years?
Well, I mean, I think in terms of finance as well, like, you know, unless you're self-funding your feature, you know, people like to see some of your other work. So they don't say, okay, here's a $10 million feature. Let's just chuck this person on who's never done any commercials, any music videos, any short films, any anything. I mean, it's very unlikely that will happen unless you're self-funding or you have private money.
Yeah, I'm sort of more meaning like, how does one know what needs to be done? You just know from years of doing it.
Yeah. So that's what I did. Like when I started making short films, I mean, I just absolutely loved it. So I made one a year and I'd learn because the first couple, and I wrote them all myself as well, wrote and directed, even one I cast myself in. But I edited the first couple as well. And I'm not a great editor. I'm a good storyteller, but in terms of pushing buttons and like being, like editors are just brilliant, you know. But I learned a lot through trying to edit those films myself. Yeah. Yeah. And I still learn the most, the most I learn is in the edit period, like when I'm working with like Tom Eagles, I work with a lot. Because that's when you see what you should have done or what you could have done.
What do you mean there? Like,
for example, I directed that. I didn't quite direct the tone right there.
Yeah.
Or in terms of coverage, I really needed to get a two shot. Whereas I went straight in from the wide to the singles. Yeah. Why would I do that? And so I've learned. And so through the editing process, you think, and you store all that information away until either pickups, if you're lucky enough to be able to do pickups, or to the next project. You go, I learned that thing. Never go from the wide and just into singles. Just tell people you need more time.
Yeah, and that's why people keep coming back to it, right?
It's
just that life. You just want to keep hone and hone. Yeah. And how is it sitting on opening night watching something that's, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours long that you've made? It must be
interesting
out of body kind of, you know, I just think filmmaking is such an incredible art form. Like, you know, to sit there and go, everything I've been through and here's this
it's all locked
story
off
for you guys to eat popcorn and look at, you know?
I mean, I absolutely love it. When I haven't directed much theatre recently, hardly at all, actually. I directed a show for Young and Hungry maybe 5 years ago, and that was terrifying, sitting in the audience on opening night.
Yeah.
But with film, like, you have watched, you've been editing for 10 weeks, 12 weeks. Inland Road, I was editing for over a year on and off, because I couldn't quite get it right. So you're so used to seeing it. You've had test screenings with audiences. You've had, but with theatre, it really is like, lights up.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, please don't fuck this up.
Because
come on, guys. And you have no control.
Yeah.
Whereas you have ultimate control as a film director. You go, shave just a frame off there. Yeah. Let's try that. So I don't find it terrifying for film.
And so when you said you'd come on over, I didn't feel great about the fact that I haven't seen the Breaker Upperas. And it wasn't because I didn't know it was on and that you were involved and it was getting good feedback and so on. It was just that I was really busy, and then I went to go and watch it, and it had finished on general release. So with that, I was going to ask, there's any number of examples. Was it Gaylene Preston that made the biopic about Helen Clark? I think
yes,
so. Right.
Yes.
So all these things that I'd go and see in a flash, before we talk about the Breaker Upperas a bit more, again, I'm just conscious of all this great work, sometimes just disappearing. Where will I be able to see it? Is it going to get some sort of streaming release or...
Well, the Breaker Upperas, let me tell you, big DVD run happening soon.
Nice.
So if you can find a way...
I've got a DVD
2018.
Player.
Oh, really?
Look, it was in the hallway and I thought, bugger it, I'm going to plug it in.
I was kind of surprised when our producer said, no, we're going to do some DVDs. I was like, how do you even play a DVD?
Yeah.
But so that's happening. We have sold to Netflix US.
That's amazing. You'll know it's all over when this... I'm just opening the one on the side of my computer, folks.
Oh my,
once that's gone... Yeah.
Your computer must be very old because they went a long time ago. I can't believe you've still got a one of those disk drive things on your computer.
Hey, that's a DVD drive. Netflix US.
Yeah. Those guys will be able to see it. The rest of the world will be able to see it.
Well, that opens up a whole other topic that one of my worries with Netflix and similar services is that we as New Zealanders will lose the identity side of our programming. Like, I worry that, how local kids' shows will start to disappear. You know how people are sort of moving away from broadcast TV? So in a wider sense, I think that's great that, our content is ending up, from a selfish local point of view,
we're exporting it.
Well, I just think that we can't end up in a world with just American and British accents
We need to get back into, quotas for New Zealand content.
Yeah.
That's right. It's up to the commissioners here.
You have the idea, like a lot of great ideas, they just sort of come to you. Whatever you're doing, I can't remember, in the many press junket conversations I saw you have.
Exactly.
What were you doing? Making a sandwich? Something very banal.
It was
happening.
Very banal. I was just mucking about at home, actually. And I did, I just thought, I thought up the premise. I just thought, what about, a couple of women who run a breakup business for cash?
And it's such a good idea that, please don't take this the wrong way, but it's a big world out there. I thought, shit, I wonder if that's been done before.
Mm.
And you obviously thought that too, and it hadn't.
No, I mean, halfway through writing, our producer, Cathy Neal, did send us maybe it was French? There was a similar kind of thing where a dude...
A Palestinian slapstick comedy from 1974. That
a dude would kind of pretend... But that was to... I can't quite remember. So he would seduce, but he was more like he would seduce one of the partners and things.
Yeah.
Whereas the characters that Madeline and I play, we have nothing to do with them. Like, one of our rules is you give us the cash,
so
we do the business, and we never want to hear from you ever, ever again because we don't care about you.
It's so dark. It's so funny.
It is. And so what happens?
And a good reaction. I mean, when I read the premise, I went, yeah. So you must have heard people just going, that's a great idea.
Yeah, we did, and the biggest feedback when we were Madeline and I would tell people the idea while we were writing, and a lot of people said, especially women said, oh man, I could have done with that business.
Yeah,
and that was heartening.
That's
heartening.
Cherie don't want to be with you no more. Cherie don't want to be with you no more. Cherie don't want to be with you no more. I'm sorry, Jeff, it's over.
What?
But with collaborating on a script, is it sit down together like writer's room style, or is it I'll write this part and then forward it to you? And how do you do that as a duo?
Yeah, we tried every which way, actually. Yeah. So it was produced through Picky Films, which and their development process is very collaborative, which I really like. So we would sit around and do table reads with other Picky writers, and people would chip in with ideas. And then we would have workshops where we would employ actors and have stand-up read-throughs. But Madeline was living in LA at the time and I was in Auckland, so we did do some writing separately. We would pass the draft, which was tricky because, of course, I'd take it in one direction, I'd send it to her, she had taken it in a different direction, send it back to me. So it worked best when we got together in the same room and just like locked ourselves in. And we're like, we can't have a glass of wine because we're working above a bar. Which was great. But it was like, we can't start drinking until we've written 17 pages.
This is so broad. What's the Madeline bits and what's the Jackie bits in terms of what you brought to the script?
Well, very broadly speaking,
like, is one of you fart jokes and the other one's like dark humour, is, you know.
Well, the interesting conversation that we always were having was we were both trying to balance up kind of gags and versus story. And you hope that they're not kind of clashing and in competition with each other, but sometimes they are. And I guess broadly speaking, you know, I would say I think we should lose that gag because I think we need to advance the story in this moment. And Madeline, very broadly speaking, would often be like, oh, I think we should play the gag and and the story will, we can fix the story.
Yeah.
You know, the story will happen. And so our collaboration was about making sure that both things happen simultaneously.
Yeah.
I mean, our number one was that we wanted it to be funny. And we both agreed on that. It's like, it has to be funny. But we also both agreed there has to be some sort of story or some underlying kind of relationship story.
Yeah.
It can't just be gags because it will feel too sketchy.
Well, also gag sort of can almost be like just one long lead break through a song. You know,
and so it was tricky, you know, with a premise like that, which is quite OTT.
Yeah.
The real challenge for us was to kind of try and ground that larger than life premise in the real world, so that we would seem kind of like human beings. You know, we wanted the audience to relate to us as human beings.
Are you going to get that DVD out for the Christmas market? I'm just thinking it.
I think it's coming out really soon. I think it's coming out next month.
It's a Christmas market. My mum bought Boy for two younger relatives for Christmas.
I mean, I think what should happen is they should do like buy a DVD and a DVD player, you know, maybe for the price of, because
why don't you do Breaker Up? Because DVD players, how much are they now? You could do Breaker Up, like branded USBs, like Breaker Upper is. I'm not in this racket. You just said Netflix US, and I just realised now, surely Netflix New Zealand as well.
Well, I don't know, because Mad Men are our Australasian distributors.
Yep.
And so I'm not sure if they've done a deal with an online platform in this territory yet. I don't know.
You know how you...
They will do, though.
They will. You wouldn't have an hour and 20 minutes in you?
Oh, have we finished?
No.
Oh.
But that sounded... Should we just shut this down? That sounded too keen.
I've got to go and buy a pair of shoes.
How long do you think we've been going?
Oh.
7.5 minutes. No.
I'll tell you. I'm going to... Because it feels like about 23 minutes, but I know from experience we've probably been going about 47.
Hour and 15.
Have we?
Yeah.
Whoa.
So we'll probably wrap it up pretty much.
And you're sitting down again.
I am sitting down again. What is it that's crunched?
You're crunching your lower lumbar.
Crunching my lower lumbar, but it's been enjoyable. It's great to see you again. I was going to ask about family. Actually, that's what we'll close with. You got three kids? If I got that right?
Yes, you did.
That was going to be really awkward the way you paused.
No, I just thought you were doing a whole summary. You got three kids, you've been married for this
long.
You've
got two dogs.
You're living out there, you've got
right.
a dog.
Yeah, this is a That's Life article.
Yeah, and I want to talk about very briefly the project I'm doing right now, which I'm very excited about. Can
but
I do
but
that?
Yes, absolutely. But your oldest is.
Now, I've got three kids.
Yeah.
June, who's 11.
Yeah.
Emmett, who's 9,
yep.
Cassie, who's 6, and yep. they're Van Griffins, because I'm married to Jesse Griffin, I'm Jackie Van Beek, so what we did horribly is just like smash our names together,
yep.
and they are Van Griffin, I can't even say it,
yeah.
Van Griffins,
yeah.
And we've got a dog called Tilly, I guess Van Griffin.
Okay, this is becoming like a That's Life article, and
They're great kids,
and all I wanted to ask about them was, because sometimes, you know, you just end up doing totally not what your parents... You've got two performers. Are they all going to be performers? Is one of them going to... I mean, you know, it's not saying that you're going to make them that, but can you? Is it coming out in them, or is one of them like, no way?
No, they are all they are all showing enthusiasm and flair in very different flavours. Cassie,
great.
Who's 6, quite big on musical theatre at the moment.
Yeah.
Emmett, he's been doing like Jono and Ben sketches with those guys. And June, a bit more kind of introspective. I'm thinking drama, although she is very dry and very funny.
Oh, excellent.
Bit surly though, you know, getting into that tween age kind of...
I was just going to say, coming, you know, girl coming into that, you know, intermediate, early college... It's a big change.
We were having a little bit of an interchange, a bit of a heated interchange last night in the car after the dog walk, and she said this brilliant line. She was really quite upset and quite angry at me, and I laughed, and I turned around and I said, man, if that was an audition for like surly 11-year-old, you would have got the role. And she did not appreciate
that.
I thought that was a really nice thing to say. She was like, oh, Mum, don't say that. That makes me feel so bad.
You got another two or three years of that.
Oh, gosh. Okay, I want to just quickly talk about the project I'm doing now, okay? Because I always get so excited about the thing I'm doing right now.
Oh, that's good.
And it's not about just going to buy my pair of shoes.
What are you going to buy?
I'm going to buy 2 pairs of New Balance.
Nice. Where from?
I've Googled it, the New Balance store. And I think it's in Beresford Street, but I don't know where that... I'm going to Google it again. As soon as you turn off this thing, I'm Googling where the New Balance outlet
Beresford,
store is.
I know where that is. And is there a special deal on 2?
No, I just want to buy 2 because I don't often get time to go to the shoe store.
Well, I don't want to hold you back from that. What are you working on, Jackie?
Huh.
Aside from shoes buying.
Well, thanks for asking, Lewis. But right now, I just am so excited about it. I'm working on this really cool improvised comedy series called Educators. It's for TVNZ On Demand because they were the only people that got really excited about us not giving them any scripts and them giving us a lot of... not a lot of money, but certainly money. And it's created by Johnny Bruff, myself, and Jesse Griffin. And Jesse's written all the story beats, and he's directing it. And we've just got so many, like, funny... I've never laughed so much on set for so long.
People improvise, like, Whose Line Is It Anyway?
A series. It's called Educators. It's set in a school. We're all playing teachers, and we've had, like... sex ed workers coming in. It's just so many brilliant. And it just reminds me of how many funny people there are in this country.
That's right. We're a funny bunch.
So many.
And where will that air eventually? Will that be in the TVNZ camp or the MediaWorks camp?
Yeah, no, that's a TVNZ On Demand series at the moment. So... Very excited.
It's been a pleasure. It's great to see you after probably 23 years or something.
I know, it's been a while.
Well, you know, in the flesh and all of that.
Yeah.
Good luck on the shoes.
Thank you.